one of the only add-on specials from Penn State.
Actually, there are like 3 employees at Penn State named Larry Smith. not so surprising. So not really the one that I'm even from Penn State. Okay, so my name is Adam Smith. I just joined the faculty at Penn State. And I'll be talking with a rather vague title, Cryptography with Quantum Data. So this talk is sort of, a lot of research in this building and in the community in general is focused on trying to understand what cryptography looks like in a quantum world, in a world where both sort of the protagonists of cryptography, the honest people in the protocol, people running protocols, and also the adversaries have access to quantum computers. And the basic point is that the landscape of crypto actually changes quite a bit. So there are new features that appear, new difficulties that arise, and some pieces that seem to stay more or less the same, but it's very interesting to try and understand what this new landscape looks like. And generally, I would say we've had some sort of successes in this field, but what are still needed to a large extent are tools, like mathematical tools, and also a kind of a language for reasoning about quantum adversaries. And when I say language, I mean it in an informal sense. Sort of terminology and a way of thinking about quantum adversaries that makes it easier to understand when protocols break and what's going on. So the field is still very young. We've had some significant successes, some quite significant mistakes, but just generally, sort of, there's still lots of questions to try and answer, and lots of things that still need to be understood. So here's a very partial list of things that change. I guess, the one that gets certainly the most attention is a statistically secure or information theoretically secure key exchange. The fact that factoring and the discrete log assumption are broken in the presence of an adversary with a quantum computer certainly changes the way people think about what computational assumptions make sense, and I think I even heard the term post-quantum used by outside of the quantum community, which really amazed me. So that was due to Shor, and of course there are several other number theoretic-based schemes that were broken by later work of Sean Holgren, who, by the way, will be joining the faculty at Penn State in September. Just a little plug there. We know that things like coin flipping and bit commitment in their strictest sense still require computational assumptions in the quantum world, but weak versions of those primitives can be achieved. Some sort of weak versions of coin flipping and string commitment and various other kind of related tasks. Some of the multi-prover commitment schemes, which are just trivially secure in the classical world, basically break if the adversaries can share entanglement instead of simple classical correlations. Tools that are called extractors, which are very widely used in classical cryptography, some of these objects actually fail to work when the adversary may have quantum information about a secret rather than only classical information. Some of them still work, but not all. And when it comes to more protocol-type tasks, some simulators for zero-knowledge proofs fail miserably. And this was actually had people sort of stuck for quite a while, although recently John Watcher showed that sometimes new simulators can, in fact, be built. But there are still many questions there. And another nice example is the so-called bounded storage model, which received a lot of attention in classical cryptography. Is shown to be much more powerful and probably much more realistic also, at least for now, in the quantum setting. That was worked by Dan Carrefour, Savai, and Christian Schopenhauer. Thank you. Yeah, the S stands for Christian. Okay. So what I'd like to do is sort of give a few salient features of this kind of quantum landscape. And this is a very partial list in both senses of the word partial, meaning incomplete and heavily biased. So I'll talk about multi-party quantum computation tasks. So parties, there's a group of parties who hold quantum inputs, and they want to jointly evaluate a quantum circuit in such a way that they want the protocol to be secure. So they all want to know the outcome of running this quantum circuit. They don't want cheaters in the protocol to learn anything more than just this outcome. And I'll discuss two sort of basic feasibility results along these lines. So one is that statistically secure multi-party quantum computation is possible if and only if there's a minority of the players in the protocol are cheating. So if and only if, in other words, the strict majority of the players are actually following the protocol honestly. And this is sort of a quantum generalization of a result of Robin and Van Oort in 1989. And on the other, the second result is that computationally secure protocols exist which tolerate arbitrary subsets of cheaters. And this is sort of a classic, again, a generalization of a classical work of Goldbeck, Mikhaly, and Vigdorsson from 1987. So this is recent unpublished work. And it holds only under a sort of non-standard assumption, which may in fact be false, I'm not sure. So I'll try to explain a little bit about what I know about that. Along the way, hopefully we'll see some infeasibility results and learn a little bit about authentication and approximate error correcting codes. This is slightly out of date, meaning some of this is 2 years old or something. And then we'll also talk about zero knowledge proofs of knowledge, and that's much more recent. Okay, so a common thread to this talk is that I'll try to sort of massively oversimplify quantum cryptography by trying to boil it all down to sort of information versus disturbance. So this is kind of an important principle of quantum mechanics and quantum information is when you measure a system, you may cause changes in it. And a consequence of this is the Noponian theorem. So in its simplest form, if I've got a unitary operator that takes as input a quantum state and has two outputs, systems A and B, then the Noponian theorem says that if the top system is always equal to the input for all inputs, for all possible quantum states, then the bottom system is independent of the input. So this is a special case of the Noponian theorem, and it sort of illustrates this idea that if B were to have any information at all about the input, then it would be disturbing. So it would be disturbing A and stopping A from being a faithful copy of the input. But in crypto, this gets used in the other way, in the other direction, which is that if information implies disturbance, then in some sense, if I've got a system that is resilient to errors, then I can use that to conclude something about secrecy. So this is, again, a sort of an oversimplification, but I'll try to use that as a common thread to sort of connect these various things. Okay, so this is an outline of the talk. I'll introduce you to sort of multi-party computing, quantum computing, a little bit about codes and authentication. Then I'll talk about multi-party quantum computing with a cheating minority. That was the first feasibility result I mentioned. And then quantum computing in the presence of arbitrary subsets of cheaters. And specifically, we'll look at proofs of knowledge for quantum. Okay, so classical multi-party computation, this is new to you, I'll just go through a quick refresher. So we've got N parties in the system, Alice, Bob, Charlie, Diane, Eve, Fred, George, Harry, etc. Each party has some private input X sub I, And everyone wants to learn the output of some classical circuit applied to the vector of their joint vector of their inputs. Okay, so maybe we all have our medical information, and what we'd like to do is somehow jointly mine this large database to figure out which factors are most strongly correlated to the occurrence of diabetes in a population. So what we want from a protocol is that everybody learns the outcome of the circuit applied to this large joint vector, but the problem is that cheaters may want to learn more. And so what we'd like is a protocol that behaves like some sort of ideal protocol where we had a trusted party running the circuit for us. So we would like a protocol which simulates the following setup. We've got a trusted central authority, and everybody passes their input to this trusted central authority who applies the circuit to the inputs, tells everybody the result, and then forgets everything he ever saw, or she. And so we want a protocol that should behave like this ideal model. And the sort of resource we'll measure for how good a job we've done is the number of honest players we need to have in the protocol for this statement to hold. Okay? So what we'll look at are results where, depending on, as long as the number of honest players is above a certain threshold, then the protocol really does behave like this abstract ideal setting. So the quantum version of this is very similar. Everybody now holds a quantum system, and they receive some quantum output, and they agree on the classical description of a quantum circuit they would all like to run. And this quantum circuit will have n outputs, and each person gets one of the system's output by the quantum circuit. And what we'd like is to construct a protocol that behaves, for all intents and purposes, like as if there were a trusted party who were running the circuit for us. Okay. So what's weird is that not everybody in the protocol may be, some people in the protocol may not be following the protocol exactly. They may be trying to cause it to make errors. They may be trying to learn things they shouldn't. And yet we still like the protocol as a whole to behave robustly. So this generalizes classical multi-party computation, but on the other hand, new techniques are needed. So unlike in classical protocols, players can't keep copies of their input. Rewinding, which is a very widely used proof technique in the classical literature, rewinding may not work here. And we may need to operate on encoded or encrypted quantum states. And the techniques, again, for doing this with classical data don't necessarily make sense. So before I try and summarize the results, let me just introduce some terminology. So there are actually many variants on this problem, but one important one is whether or not we allow abort in the protocol. So when a protocol aborts, honest players all stop and output some special string that says, they just say abort. And what that means is all the honest players agree that something bad happened in the protocol. There were some cheaters that were causing problems, and they've just decided that they're not going to go through the protocol because they're afraid that, too much information is going to get leaked. So there are settings where cheaters can actually force the protocol to abort. And in this talk is what's furthermore called unfair abort, where the cheaters first receive their outputs from the trusted quantum circuit, and then decide whether or not, based on those, whether or not they want to force the protocol to abort. This is what I mean by with abort. And then beyond that, we can sort of measure the strength of security of a protocol in various different ways. So we'll say a protocol is computationally secure if, with overwhelming probability, a polynomial time adversary learns nothing and cannot cause the protocol to fail. Statistically secure if, with overwhelming probability, any adversary whatsoever, no matter what his running time is, learns nothing. And we'll say it's perfectly secure if this happens actually with probability 1. Okay, so the first relaxation is in the computational power, the second relaxation is a relatively minor one, I think, of going from statements which hold with overwhelming probability 1 minus something exponentially small to some statements which hold with probability 1. Okay, so we can actually sort of plot these results on a sort of a graph, if you will. I don't know, this is the best way I could come up getting everything in one slide. So on the horizontal axis, we have the number of cheaters in the protocol, typically bounded by some fraction of the total number of people, which is n. And there's a classical result from 88 is that perfect multi-party computation can be achieved, classical multi-party computation can be achieved as long as fewer than a third of the parties are cheating. And this way, a year later, it was extended by Robin and Benor to show that, in fact, if you're willing to allow a small probability of error, exponentially small, then you can actually tolerate any faulty minority. And this is, all these results are assuming the availability of a broadcast channel, just because it cleans things up a bit. If you want to know what happens without a broadcast channel, you can ask me. And what goes along with this is the result that perfect multi-party computation is impossible beyond this threshold. So these two results are in fact tight. The perfect result is tight, and in fact, the second result is also tight. So statistical multi-party computing is impossible even if you allow a Bohr. Okay? And this is maybe what the result generalizes to, in particular, follows from the fact that, say, bit commitment is impossible and oblivious transfer are impossible with two parties. But what is also sort of complementing that is the result of Gilbreth and McCullough and Pigerson says that computational multi-party computation protocols exist tolerating any number of cheaters as long as we're willing to allow the cheaters to force the protocol to abort. Now, basically, this aborting thing is unavoidable once you have a majority of cheating players, because even in the two-party setting, one player can always just walk away, and then the other player is left with nothing. Okay, so you can always, once there are enough cheaters, they can always force the protocol to just grind to a halt. But remarkably, they can't do anything more than that, as long as they're computationally bound. And as long as it goes on, we assume the existence of one-way functions, trapped room permutations. Okay. So this is a rough picture of what things look like in the classical world. And what happens in the quantum world is these results all still hold. The perfect and statistical protocols are continue to be secure. The impossibility results continue to hold, although this one took a while for people to check. This is basically the result that bit commitment and OT and coin flipping and so forth are impossible even with quantum protocols.
But each of the classical protocols remain secure or impossible.
So this says that if we're interested in classical tasks, it seems those four feasibility results remain untouched. Okay? And there's one question mark here. And basically, what was a problem for a while was that it seemed the last result there, the computational result, did not carry through to the quantum setting. And that it has to do with the existence one of the problems was the fact that we didn't even know how to construct zero knowledge proofs, which are an important special case of the general result. Okay, and I'll talk more about zero knowledge proofs later. So this is the sort of pseudo-optimistic view we had of the classical protocols in the presence of quantum adversaries. In the way this extends, if we look in the quantum world, then in fact, there's a sort of a similar flavor of results. So Benor, Jacob, Gottesman, Hasidim, and myself showed recently that the statistical multi-party quantum computation is also actually possible as long as, for arbitrary quantum circuits, as long as the as long as there's an honest majority of players in the protocol. And this is sort of a strengthening of an earlier result of ours from 2002, saying that that the statement held when there were less than a sixth of players were in the protocol were cheating. And what the analog of this result, the classical result that perfect protocols are impossible beyond n over 3, is that perfect quantum protocols are actually impossible beyond n over 4. Okay, and this is a result, well, actually proved in 2002 that we didn't know it at the time. And
we knew it at the time, we thought we would prove something more.
Right, okay. We didn't know this was the statement. Okay. And then statistical multi-party computation is impossible even with the port. Beyond that, that's just the, you know, that's just a trivial consequence of what's up on the line, but on the top. And so these are all published results, and then what I'd like to get to towards the end of the talk is that, in fact, we can extend these protocols to give us computationally secure protocols if we allow a board in the presence of an arbitrary subset of cheating parties, and this in particular allows us to recover the original result of GNW, which wasn't clear whether or not it held. So the star here is that this result on computational protocols holds modulo somewhat unnatural assumption, which I'll try to explain to you later. So this is kind of a bird's eye view, and if you kind of understand this picture and nothing else in the talk, that's fantastic. So the first half of the talk, I'll try to focus on the left half, and then the next part of the talk, I'll try to focus on the left half, and then on the right half. So what was the picture? So in 2002, we were able to using sort of techniques from error correction and fault tolerant circuits, we were able to show that we could do multi-party protocols that tolerated up to n over 6 cheaters. And as I was preparing the slides for this talk, it occurred to me that this is possibly the second kind of really solid proof of security of protocols versus quantum adversaries. The first being the various proofs of the security of key distribution. Although I'm not sure, maybe I'm being unfair to somebody. Daniel, did you agree with this bullet?
Well,
no.
First of all, when is the authentication paper? It's around the same time.
Earlier. Later. I mean, later.
It was published later, but we actually wrote it. No, really. I mean, we said. Well, anyway, that's it.
But there are other protocols, maybe not so interesting. I'm not sure exactly what you consider a protocol, what you consider a security proof, right? So it's.
Right. Okay. So maybe this is unreasonable for me. Okay, so the point is, we don't have that many different ways of proving security of protocols for quantum adversaries. We just don't know that much. But basically, what was clear was that these protocols ran into a barrier at n over 4, and this is due to bounds on the performance of quantum codes, and the fundamental bounds on how good error correcting codes can be for correcting quantum information, bounds that I think are due to Nil and Laplan. And what I'd like to try and explain is that what we figured out later, which is that once we looked at a seemingly different task, which was for constructing authentication codes for authenticating quantum information, then these gave us approximate error-correcting codes, which would go beyond this N over 4 barrier, and allow us to sort of extend this bar past the N over 4 dotted line. And the main idea is that there's some kind of reduction between the, from the full generality of quantum computation to executing classical reductions, classical computations on authentication keys, and this is what allows us to kind of make the protocols work. So what I'll like try to explain is sort of the main ideas here. So I'll like to just, I'll have a quick review of quantum error correcting codes, explain a sort of spurious lower bound on multi-party computation protocols and why authentication and approximate codes allow us to get around this. So what's an error correcting code? It's a map from k qubits to n qubits that introduces redundancy. And the idea is that if relatively few qubits are corrupted or erased, then the decoder should be able to recover the input exactly. Okay? And of course, this is tricky precisely because of no cloning. And for example, the obvious thing to do with classical data, which is just to repeat it many times independently, doesn't work with quantum information. Sorry. asymptotically good codes do exist, however, and over a large alphabet, they are capable of correcting an arbitrary corruption of n minus 1 over 4 arbitrary positions, or they're also capable of correcting up to n over 2 erasures. This is a result of the Hauer and Ackermann. So, so good codes can correct. They can correct a quarter of the errors or half of the erasures, and this is as good as they do as they can do. So quantum codes cannot correct n over 4 or more errors, and that's because, as in the classical case, if you can correct t errors, then you can correct 2t plus 1 erasures. So, sort of the classical picture is like this. If you can correct t errors, it means that all balls are radius t around your code words are disjoint. And if you can correct 2t plus 1 erasures, it means that any ball of radius 2t plus 1 contains, 2t, actually, there's an extra plus 1 on the picture. Any ball of radius 2t contains no other code words, right? And it's pretty easy to see these are actually exactly equivalent statements in the classical case. And in the quantum case, a very similar picture holds, except it's basically harder to draw. So, on one hand, we can correct errors, we can correct 2t plus 1 erasures. On the other hand, quantum codes cannot correct n over 2 erasures. Because if suppose they could, well, we basically run into the no coding theorem. So suppose we could correct n over 2 erasures. What we can do is take the code word, cut it in half, run a decoder on the first half, run a decoder on the second half, and obtain independent copies of your state, and that would violate the no coding theorem we saw earlier. And so, since quantum codes can't correct n over 2 erasures, they can't correct n over 4 errors. Right? And this is not true in the classical case. For example, just a repetition code will correct n minus 1 over 2 errors. So quantum codes are really fundamentally limited in comparison to classical codes. And this led us to the following sort of spurious lower bound on the possibility of constructing protocols which tolerate a large number of cheating parties. So here's an attempt at a lower bound. This lemma I think probably appeared in the paper. Every multi-party computing protocol tolerating cheat cheaters implies existence of a code correcting T errors with high fidelity. Okay, and roughly speaking, the reason this is true is because if I've got a protocol which can tolerate T arbitrary cheaters, then in particular the protocol should be able to deal with what happens when those T cheaters get up and walk away. Okay, so if those T cheaters get up and walk away, I should be able to reconstruct the output of the protocol based only on what's currently held by the honest parties. And so, given that if the honest parties can reconstruct the output, then basically if I look at this whole protocol, the state of all the parties as some kind of as a code word, then this code word can allows me to correct T errors with high fidelity. And so in this paper with Claude Defoe and Daniel, we concluded multi-party computation, quantum computation is impossible for up to n over 4 errors, for is impossible when t is when t is greater or equal to n over
4. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Why would you want to reconstruct the outputs that are being sent to the cheaters?
You don't. You want to be able to. So actually, I'll be more specific. So in particular, one of the things you should be able to do with such a protocol is to have players. So one of the things. Suppose we had a trusted party who were helping us do our computation. One of the things you'd like to be able to. One of the things you can do with a trusted party is have somebody hand him a value, and at some later point, ask him to send that value to one, let's say one of the honest players. Okay. If you want to have that functionality, then you should, in particular, be able to deal with when somebody gives something to the trusted party, and then the cheaters walk away. You still want to be able to simulate that trusted party then giving the value to an honest player. Does that make sense?
In particular, it's not when the cheaters walk away, that's the hardest part, it's when they say and do something.
Right, I'm sorry, yeah, so, okay. In fact, yeah, that's a good point. So the issue is not when they walk away, it's when they hang around and then broadcast garbage. Or insidiously crafted messages that are meant to be confusing. So what we concluded is that multi-party computation is impossible when the number of cheaters is n over 4 or greater. And the issue was so strictly speaking, this statement is false, so what's going on? So the issue is this with high fidelity statement in the lemma. So what this argument shows is that perfect multi-party computation protocols are indeed impossible. Okay, but it doesn't rule out protocols that succeed with overwhelming probability, or that do the right thing with overwhelming fidelity to the or simulate a trusted party with overwhelming fidelity. So how do we get around this? Well, we'll use authentication codes and to construct approximate codes that break this bound, and I'll try to explain this sort of a connection to classical secret sharing. So first thing we need are authentication codes. This may be reviewed, but I'll go through it anyway. So imagine we have two parties, Alice and Bob, who want to communicate to each other. So Alice can ask, well, Bob, in the quantum world, how can we be sure? But in fact, the more important question she should be asking is, how does she know she's actually speaking to Bob, right? So in a classical conversation, we have these tools called message authentication codes, which allow us to authenticate communications, but the question is what if Bob needs to send her qubits? So this leads to the following sort of class of tasks. So Alice gets some quantum state psi that she wants to send to Bob, and she and Bob share some classical key K. Alice encodes this key using an authentication code, sends it towards Bob, but it might get authenticated, it might get interrupted in the way by Eve. And what we'd like is that Bob be sort of, Bob will only output either the state that Alice had in mind, or the state that Alice sent, rather, or a special symbol indicating that he detected the problem on the channel. Okay. So this is the definition of a quantum authentication code. It should be allowing you to execute this task and have this guarantee. And basically, this is sort of like saying that the system behaves kind of like a channel with veto. So Alice is allowed, it can send something over the channel to Bob, and the only thing Eve can do, Eve's input is is just a single bit. So she just has one bit which says either she accepts that the message go through, or she rejects, and Bob gets nothing. And indeed, in fact, you can sort of strengthen this that by the no cloning theorem, if this protocol works for arbitrarily quantum states, then in the case that Bob accepts, Eve in fact learns nothing. So this is sort of an immediate consequence of the no cloning theorem. What's perhaps more surprising is that Eve learns nothing ever, even if Bob doesn't accept. Okay, so there's this weird connection between authentication and encryption. In a Fox 2002 paper, we showed that polynomial time protocols for this task actually exist, and we can authenticate n qubits using roughly 2m plus some logarithmic number of bits of key. The second term is roughly the security parameter of the scheme. Okay, so you can authenticate n qubits using around twice that many bits of key. So why are these useful for solving our problem? Based on authentication codes we can construct, we can sort of get around this n over 4 bound in the construction of quantum codes. So what we can show is that we'd like to, now given this authentication code, we'd like to build an error-correcting code that corrects, in some sense, up to n over 2 errors. And the idea is to start with an n over 2 erasure-correcting code, and we'll authenticate each piece. Okay, so we encode our state using some code which corrects n over 2 erasures, and now we authenticate each piece by running the authentication protocol that Alice ran earlier. And then the output, the encoding, consists of all these authenticated pieces plus a classical secret sharing of the keys used to authenticate the various pieces. Okay, so this is sort of a reasonably accurate, but maybe oversimplified picture of what's going on. So what's the idea? This is the actual encoding, and this actually gives some kind of approximate code that corrects n minus 1 over 2 errors. So if a majority of the pieces are untouched, then by basically using this classical share, reconstructing the keys that were shared by this classical sharing, what we can do is basically check each of the pieces of the encoding to see whether or not it was tampered. And we're sort of converting errors into erasures, because everything that's tampered with we just throw away, and everything that's untampered with we keep, and using those untampered states, we can then recover the original state to be encoded. And this has no sort of classical, this type of object has no classical analog in coding theory. Okay, in classical codes, there's no difference between what you can do with high probability and what you can do with probability 1 when it comes to adversarial errors. Okay, so I'd like to try and sort of put a different spin on that. which is, so these error correcting, approximate quantum error correcting codes somehow, to a cryptographer such as myself, smell like secret sharing. So the construction I just illustrated is very similar and I guess inspired by construction of Robin and Benor from 89. And this is no coincidence. So Cleve, Boxman, and Lowe, all three of the audience, I guess, showed that every quantum code is, in fact, a secret sharing scheme. And this is exactly the by the no cloning theorem again, that if given the stuff that's erased, if I can recover the encoded state from the complement, then the erased information must contain no information at all. So what's the lesson we can view from this is that these types of approximate quantum error correction are in some sense best viewed as robust secret sharing schemes. This is in the classical literature, there's a primitive called perfectly secure message transmission. The name doesn't mean much, maybe, but it is basically a classical analog of this of approximate quantum codes, where you want error correction, but you also want some kind of secret sharing-like guarantee. So essentially, that somehow I think that the lesson I like to draw on this is not only do quantum codes imply secret sharing, but secret sharing is really the correct classical analog of quantum error correction, and that the kinds of phenomena you see in quantum error correction are probably more accurately reflected in classical secret sharing, and vice versa. When you've got a new question on quantum error correcting codes, it may be a good idea to go and look at classical secret sharing schemes and see if there's some analogous phenomenon going on there. And this is, you know, one more piece in Silvio Micali's claim that cryptography is everything. But if you guys haven't met Silvio, then this may not seem quite as entertaining as it is to me. So he goes around trying to claim it. Cryptography is going to solve the world's problems. Okay, so this is sort of as I said, the picture that I wanted to explain, that we've got this kind of world of quantum protocols, and that to some extent mirrors the behavior of the classical world, except that for some strange reason, the N over 3 threshold has moved to N over 4. And I don't really have a good explanation of why that is beyond the fact it's true. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is sort of switch gears and take a look at what happens. So stepping back. In the presence of an honest majority, the questions we have to answer are very much about coding and secret sharing, these kind of information theoretic objects. And when we sort of look at what happens on the right side, then the picture changes and the types of objects we need to deal with change dramatically. And I'd like to try and give you some idea of how we can deal with such settings. Okay, so given the time, I'll skip. Before going to this computational protocols, I wanted to explain some of the ideas behind the statistical multi-party computing protocol, but I think I'd rather not do that. Okay, so this is just a summary slide for what I didn't show you. Okay, so now I just sort of gave you some of the ideas hiding in the constructions of protocols for handling an honest cheating minority or an honest majority. What about what happens when you've got a faulty majority? And it turns out that sort of it's sufficient somewhat magically to consider the two-party case. This is a lesson of classical cryptography, I guess, but it carries over to the quantum case, quantum setting here, is that anytime you can prove a basic feasibility result for a two-party computation, you can more or less extend it to a multi-party setting with an arbitrary number of cheaters, and vice versa, anything you can prove in the multi-party setting holds also in the two-party setting. So I'll just talk about two-party protocols, and I'll try to focus on proofs of knowledge for quantum adversaries. So two-party quantum computation. The basic claim is that, returning to the picture for a second, the basic claim is that we can, under a somewhat weird computational assumption, we can get protocols for any quantum circuit tolerating an arbitrary number of people, number of cheaters. So what's the basic idea? So we take many of the ideas from the earlier protocols, but now these approximate quantum codes are replaced by commitment schemes. So in order to commit to a quantum state to Bob, Alice authenticates the state using an authentication code. And now instead of having a key which is shared with Bob, what she does is she'll use a classical commitment scheme and commit to this key. So what does a commitment mean? It means that Alice sends Bob something like an encryption of the key K, which allows him to, so he doesn't allow him to learn K, but it means that at some later point in time, Alice can't claim her key was anything but K. So she's somehow committed to this value K, even though Bob doesn't know what it is. So as before, the main idea, which I didn't explain, was to reduce the quantum computations on authenticated states to classical operations on the authentication keys, which are used to encode the states. So the reductions from the previous protocol still work here. The problem is that what we need is classical two-party secure computation. So as I mentioned, in the sort of earlier cases, the classical results carry through against a quantum adversary, and that's basically because the arguments are information theoretic and quite straightforward. In the classical setting, it's no longer true. Basically, as far as we know, the classic protocols for two-party secure computation may be insecure in the presence of a quantum adversary. What I won't explain is, in fact, the bottleneck for security against a quantum adversary is in constructing something called a zero-knowledge proof of knowledge. So I will explain what a zero-knowledge proof of knowledge is, but I won't explain why it allows you to solve the original problem. But, yeah, you'll just have to believe. Okay, so what I'd like to do for the remaining time in the talk, which is not that much, I'd like to explain how we can, or give you some idea of how to construct, of what zero-knowledge proofs of knowledge are, why and why they're problematic, and how we can try to get around this. So given a Boolean, so what's a zero-knowledge proof of knowledge? So suppose we're given a Boolean formula phi. Okay, so it's a formula, it takes n bits as inputs and outputs a single bit, either true or false. And suppose we've got two players, Alice and Bob, and Alice wants to prove to Bob that the formula is satisfiable. So satisfiability here means there exists some input to the formula which makes the formula true. Okay, so a formula is satisfiable if there's some input on which it outputs 1, and that input, any such input is called a witness. Okay, so formula is satisfiable if there exists a witness which, witnesses the fact that it's satisfiable. And in the context of the computation protocols, Alice will somehow encode the statement that she has followed the protocol faithfully so far. So I realize this is somewhat vague, but believe me that it's sufficient for each step of the protocol, Alice and Bob will convince each other that they have followed the protocol faithfully so far, and then they can sort of keep going. So what they need is this subprotocol for proving that a formula is satisfiable. But the problem is that Alice doesn't want Bob to learn the witness. So but Alice could just send the witness to Bob, and then the game would be over. You know, he would know that it's satisfiable. But she doesn't want him to learn the witness. And on the other hand, Bob wants to be actually, he wants to be sure that Alice actually has a witness in mind. Okay, so these are conflicting goals. So Alice wants to convince Bob without actually telling him anything. So we want a protocol that behaves like as follows. Alice has the witness's input. They both know the formula, phi. They run some protocol, and at the end of the protocol, Bob says, okay, phi must be true, I'm convinced, but he learns nothing else. So how can we formalize this concept a little more carefully? Well, zero knowledge, there are two conditions we need to formalize. One is that Bob learns nothing about the witness, and the other is that Alice really has a witness in mind. Okay? So zero knowledge is formalized as follows. For all, I'll write it, for all Bob, which means no matter how Bob behaves, I'm very honored to be, by the way, to be giving a talk in the Bob room about Bob. It's really good, special. Okay, so for all Bob, there exists a simulator, and the simulator will somehow try to imitate Bob, but without knowing the witness. So, or rather, it will try to imitate the interaction between Alice and Bob, but without knowing W. So for all Bob, there exists a simulator such that the following holds. Ignore row for, okay, so there's this row here, and row here, ignore these for a second. So what we want is that Alice, if Alice and Bob run the normal protocol, okay, so where Alice gets a witness, they both know phi, and then at the end, we throw away Alice, we keep the transcript of the protocol, it's a classical protocol, we keep the transcript of the protocol, we keep Bob's state at the end of the protocol, and we keep something else, which I'll get to in a second. So we keep the transcript in Bob's state. And on the other hand, we have a simulator, which is somehow based on Bob, but different, which just gets the formula phi. It outputs a fake transcript and a fake version of Bob's state. And we'll say the simulator is faithful if in fact, these two outputs are indistinguishable by a polynomial time observer. So that's sort of the basic idea of zero knowledge. In fact, there's this additional condition that we want this to happen, to continue to work, even when Bob himself is entangled with some outside system. Okay, or if, in other words, if Bob is getting help from the outside. So what does that mean? Imagine we have some reference system or some arbitrary state row which is divided into two pieces, a reference system and a piece that goes to Bob. And what we'd like is that even given the reference system, the real transcript and Bob's real state together with the reference system are indistinguishable from the simulator's output together with the reference system. Okay, so it's sort of amazing that such a statement could hold, but basically it says whatever Bob learned in this protocol, he could have simulated on his own simply knowing that phi was satisfied. So it was an open question, actually, for a while, whether or not such protocols existed for quantum adversaries. And John Watrous recently showed that under reasonable assumptions, namely, I guess, the existence of one-way functions secure against quantum adversaries, quantum circuits, there exists a sound zero-knowledge proof system for satisfiability, which is secure against a quantum verifier, so quantum Bob. So what does this mean? So it means that sound just means that Soundness is the condition that Bob, that Alice can't prove false statements to Bob. If Alice tries to prove something false, she'll be caught with high probability. Okay, so that rules out protocols like believe me, the formula is satisfiable. And on the other hand, if the protocol is zero knowledge in the sense of the simulation. And he showed that these zero knowledge proof systems exist for satisfiability of formulae, which is the same as saying they exist for any MP language. And they're secure against a quantum verifier. But the problem, so this is a really lovely result from Stock last year. The problem is that it is exactly the way the soundness condition is formalized. So it turns out that the way soundness is formalized in the Watcher's paper, it's highly non-trivial, but it's not quite enough to solve the to solve the problem of building, of using these protocols, zero-knowledge protocols as building blocks in larger protocols. And what we need is a slightly different, stronger formulation of soundness, which I'll try to explain now. Okay, so I showed how to formalize zero-knowledge, but what I said is what we need are zero-knowledge proofs of knowledge. Okay, so what is a proof of knowledge? I'll go through the picture in a second, but informally, what we want is that Alice convinces Bob not only that the formula is satisfiable, but that she actually has a witness in mind. Okay, and this is non-trivial because the formula could be the formula could be something like verifying. Well, here's an example of a formula. So a formula could take two integers, binary descriptions of two integers p and q, and the formula could be 1 if p, q is equal to n. So this is a formula that somehow depends on, let's call it capital N to avoid confusion, and 0 otherwise. So this is a formula, it's a Boolean, assuming that P and Q are represented, given as in their binary representations, it's a Boolean formula. It's a polynomial size formula, it just requires multiplication. And what's kind of, let's say P Q is equal to N, we'll add a non-triviality condition, P greater than 1 and Q greater than 1. Okay, so that we have a non-trivial factorization of N. So if N is not a prime number, then this formula is necessarily satisfiable. So checking this formula for satisfiability is trivial. However, knowing a witness to the formula may not be trivial at all. Okay? So this is the distinction between soundness and proofs of knowledge, is that soundness tells you nothing about these types of formula. And these are exactly the kinds of formula that may arise in these sort of protocol constructions. So we'll try to formalize a stronger condition which says not only does Alice, not only is this formula satisfiable, but Alice actually knows an input that makes it, a witness that makes it satisfiable, that satisfies. Okay, so it's formulated in the sort of simulation condition as before, except now it's Alice who may be cheating. So for all cheating Alices, there exists a simulator such that for all entangled reference systems, the following two experiments have indistinguishable output. So on one hand, we just run the real protocol where Alice gets the state, she gets one half of the state row, and the other half just goes straight to the output. And in the other system, there's the simulator, this sort of Alice prime, which only gets row, implicitly phi also. it only gets row and outputs, again, sort of a simulated transcript, a simulation of Alice's state, and the other half of this reference system. So what we'll do is we'll compare the output of this experiment where we run a real protocol to the output of this experiment where we just run a simulation where there's no bob at all. And what we like is that these two experiments be indistinguishable. And actually that part is trivial because just the indistinguishability is trivial because the simulator could just imitate bob and run an interaction with Alice and that would be fine. So bob has no... In the case of zero knowledge, there was this extra input of the witness, but now there's no such thing. Bob in these protocols has no secret input, so there's no problem. So achieving indistinguishability is not hard. The problem is there's an extra condition. So the simulator, in addition to trying to simulate Alice's state at the end of the protocol, also has to sort of extract from Alice some string W prime, and the condition is that if the simulated transcript accepts, then W prime is actually a witness for the formula. So what is this a formalization of? So this whole setup captures somehow the fact that Alice knows a witness. So it basically says, if Alice manages to convince Bob, so that is, if the simulated transcript, if Bob accepts in this transcript, then Alice could have output a witness to the formula. So zero knowledge proofs of knowledge, they were formalized in, I don't have a reference on the slide, but I forget who, Macaulay and others, late 80s, early 90s. And they're really a fundamental concept in crypto, but they basically break down when we talk about quantum verifiers. Or rather, as far as we know. So the problem is that the standard approaches to zero knowledge, namely the standard ways of proving zero knowledge in the classical setting, both the simulation and extraction conditions, these arguments may not work in the quantum world. One common technique is rewinding, and basically that would involve sort of cloning the reference system and auxiliary information, which is impossible. and that would mean that you couldn't, sequential composition would be lost. Sequential composition means that you can use a protocol many times in sequence and not worry about weird things happening. So a big step, as I said, was Wachif's simulator for three-round zero knowledge, and that sort of deals with the zero knowledge aspect, but it doesn't give a knowledge extract. It only gives sentiments. So the idea is that we can actually repair this by sort of modifying the protocol and using Wachif's simulator as a tool to help us build a simulator for the modified protocol and an extractor. So the basic idea is that Wachif's simulator gives us a trick for lying. So what simulating zero knowledge proof means, I can prove something to you without knowing why it's true. And what we actually need to be able to do is to kind of read minds. We need to be able to extract the witness from Alice. And the idea behind the protocol is to attach a kind of preamble to the protocol, which will give us this extra feature. So here's a protocol which, under assumptions which I'll explain, is the zero knowledge proof of knowledge on verifiers. So it works as follows. Bob starts. He picks a random number A, a random string A, commits to it, and sends it to Alice. Alice picks, sends the commitment to Alice. Alice picks another random number B and sends it back to Bob. And then Bob opens his commitment to A as follows. So first, he sends, he just tells Alice, okay, I have committed to A. But rather than opening the commitment to A, so rather than telling Alice that how to check the commitment herself, what Bob will do is he'll give a zero-knowledge proof that he could have decommitted honestly to A. Okay? Now, so this is actually a coin-flipping protocol. So Bob commits, Alice sends a random number, Bob opens, and we XOR or add these numbers together. That's a sort of classic structure of a coin-flipping protocol, and indeed that's sort of the first part of this protocol. What Alice then does is she takes A and B, adds them together, so this is the coin they flip, the random string that generated, and she'll think of it as a public key for a particular encryption scheme with special properties. Now what she does is she takes her witness and she encrypts it using this public key, and she sends it across the bottom. So notice that because they run a coin flipping protocol to generate a random public key, neither of them knows the decryption key for this encryption scheme, and so neither of them knows, I mean, certainly Bob doesn't know how to decrypt W. So now what Alice will do is she'll give zero knowledge proof not only that phi is satisfiable, but that she's actually given an encryption of the witness. So intuitively, what's going on? Intuitively, this works because intuitively this is still zero knowledge because Bob, neither of them can control the coin flipping in a real execution of the protocol. Neither of them can control the coin flipping. And so Bob won't learn anything from this encryption. He won't learn anything from the zero knowledge proof. And so Bob is still learning nothing except for the satisfiability of the formula. On the other hand, the protocol is still sound simply because this zero knowledge proof is sound. So this, if this statement is true, then in particular the witness, the formula is satisfiable. So it's not very difficult to prove that this is still sound. Zero knowledge is tricky and knowledge extraction is tricky. So what we'll need are some special properties from the public key, from the encryption scheme, which are as follows. I started a bit late, so I'll just run the 2 minutes over. I promise this is like second last slide or something. So what we want is that we've got a public key encryption scheme with a special set of kind of bad public keys. A special set of good public keys. So the property should be that good public keys are very rare. Okay, so they should occupy a negligible fraction of the total space, the total number of public keys. But on the other hand, if I pick a random good key, it should be indistinguishable from just a random string. And then what we need from the bad key, let's start with the bad keys. What we need from the bad keys is that they lead to something which is not an encryption scheme at all. So if I try to encrypt two different witnesses, W1 and W2, under a bad key, then I get identical probability distributions. Okay? So under bad keys, the encryption contains strictly no information about the witness, and in particular, you can't decrypt. So when the key is bad, it's not an encryption scheme because there's no information there, you can't even decrypt. On the other hand, when the key is good, then the decryption is well defined. So the encryption of two different witnesses will yield disjoint sets of possible strings. So not only is it sort of theoretically possible to decrypt, but we also need to be able to efficiently sample secret key that goes along with the public key, where the public key is random and secret key allows us to decrypt. So what we need is on the good keys we can decrypt, but on the bad keys there's no information at all, information theoretically. An example of this would be if we take a multiplicative homomorphic encryption scheme like El-Gamal, for example, or RSA, then if we would take, then the, I could suppose we start from such an encryption scheme, I'll construct a new scheme which has these properties. The new public key will be an old public key and a ciphertext, where the ciphertext is an encryption of a random number. And then to encrypt under the new public key, I just encrypt under the old public key, and then I multiply by a random multiple of this ciphertext. If you don't know what homomorphic encryption schemes mean, it doesn't matter too much. If you do, what's going on is that this encryption procedure basically replaces the encryption of a witness with the encryption of a completely random string. On the other hand, for a public key that's in the set, so the PK prime is in the set if and only if the ciphertext is an encryption of zero. If the ciphertext C is an encryption of zero. So this happens a very small fraction of the time. Typically, you encrypt something random, you encrypt something non-zero. And then when you encrypt an encryption of one. When you multiply by an encryption of one, then you don't change the witness at all. So this gives us a scheme that when the public key comes from this special set, which occurs very rarely, then it's really an encryption scheme. But when the public key is chosen truly at random, you just get you get something that conveys no information at all. So the problem is that I don't know of natural examples. I don't know of examples of these encryption schemes which are even reasonably likely to be secure against quantum computers. So this is a sort of a weird condition on encryption schemes. It's easy to come up with lots of examples of classical encryption schemes that would fit this definition, but almost all of them are somehow based on discrete log or RSA, and I don't really know how to build them under assumptions that aren't actually broken by quantum computers. So there's this kind of wacky problem here that I only know how to prove this theorem under an assumption which, for all I know, could be false, but I really think it's true. Okay. And so that's why I'm actually talking about didn't go back to the drawing board. So what goes on under this kind of wacky assumption? Well, we've got a coin flipping. This coin flipping scheme has two important properties. When the simulator is playing the role of Bob, it can control the coin flipping. So when the simulator is sort of simulating Alice's view of the protocol, it can actually make all sorts of stuff up, and Alice won't know the difference. So what happens is that, but on the other hand, if Bob in the real protocol, Bob can't control the coin flipping. And if the simulator is playing Alice's role, then it can't control the coin flip, but it does know that the coin flip will be random. It can't control it, but it does know sort of some statistical properties. So again, in the real execution, this message, this encryption, leaks no information at all. But in a simulated execution, one of two things will happen. If the simulator is playing Bob, then he can force the public key to actually have a good decryption key, and so he can extract Alice's witness in this proof. On the other hand, when Bob is cheating and the simulator is playing Alice, then because the coin flip is still statistically random, this statement is likely to be statistically independent of anything, and so we can just run the watcher simulator, and Bob will be convinced. So the simulated I won't go into more details because I think I've gone over time. Okay, so this is the big picture, modulo this actually quite significant asterisk, which is I don't know of constructions of encryption schemes which really satisfy the conditions of this assumption, or even solid candidates. So there's sort of an interesting open problem. Nonetheless, I think the argument I've given is a strong indication that these statements still hold. So I don't know exactly how to prove them under reasonable assumptions, but I think we're sort of, you know, this far away from doing it. Okay, so that's all I wanted to tell you about cryptography in a quantum world. What I hope I've convinced you about is that the sort of tools and language for reasoning about quantum adversaries are being developed, and I showed you a few, only a very small fraction of what's out there, but we're still very far from having a good understanding of how to argue these things, and there's still lots of open questions, and I think there's sort of going to continue to be an active field of research for quite a while. Thanks. We can all go get coffee and break out now.
Questions?
The question, like, what did you just talk about? That would also be.
Is an S missing in?
Yeah.
Probably not. I don't know.
An S?
Probably not. It's okay.
Oh, Christians. Okay, I don't know if I...
So I'd be not trying to have four answers or two answers. That's the
best one. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know how to transliterate it. I claim anything phonetically equivalent is game.
Well, since it is running late...
Okay, yeah. Thanks very much.
Gerald, thanks, speaker.